Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
$1 million to date. This is a large number, but this is just the cash cost. This is just the tip of the iceberg. This is only the money used to pay for combat operations, such as combat pay, transportation, feeding the troops, providing medical care to the front lines, repairing equipment, paying fuel, paying the 100,000 or so contractors who we employ, and paying full-time salaries to National Guard and reservists who would ordinarily be paid only for one weekend a month. There are four major categories of cost that we pay in addition to that top-line cost. First, there is the cost of war spending that is hidden in the regular defense budget. Now, one anomaly of the United States budget is that wars cost extra. So we already spend $500 billion on the defense budget. And since the beginning of the war, the defense budget itself has increased by another cumulative $500 billion. We estimate that about a quarter of this is due to Iraq in one way or another, including things like enlistment bonuses of 40,000 for new troops, re-enlistment bonuses of 150,000 to keep experienced troops from leaving to go work for contractors, increased spending on recruiting, advertising, increased pay rises over and above the planned ones, increased spending for military health care. And then there are other hidden costs to other federal departments, such as the Department of Labor, which insures contractors, and the Social Security Administration. Second, there are the long-term costs that we will have to pay even if we were to withdraw tomorrow. And this is where the public really does not have a good understanding because of the lack of transparency in the government financial accounts of what we really owe. In business, there is something called accrual accounting. Accrual accounting means that you need to, if you buy a car, for example, you need to show the full cost of the car, not only the $5,000 that you put down up front. But the way the government does its books, you only have to show that $5,000. So if we look at this on an accrual basis, there are long-term costs that we have to pay, even if we were to withdraw tomorrow. And these include veterans' medical care, veterans' disability compensation, replacing military equipment, and restoring our armed forces to its pre-war strength. The cost of caring for our veterans, for our injured veterans, and paying disability is a very significant cost. This is much higher than in previous wars because the survivor rate is much higher than in previous wars. In Vietnam and Korea, there were 2.5 injuries for every fatality. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there are 7 troops wounded in action for every death. And if you include all of those who are accidentally injured, or injured through friendly fire, injured in vehicle accidents, or come down with diseases, there are 15 wounded and injured for every fatality. This is in many ways a tribute to battlefield medicine and is obviously a welcome development, but it significantly increases the cost. And currently, the Department of Veterans Affairs is overwhelmed with the number of troops who are wounded and returning, especially with the demand for mental health care, and especially in rural areas where even if they want to hire additional mental health professionals, triage nurses, and others, they often cannot hire them. Now, the cost of providing disability benefits is one of the costs that goes on for many, many years after a war is finished. We currently pay $16 billion a year in disability benefits alone for Vietnam veterans, and that number rises every year. The peak year for World War II benefits was 1993. The peak year for disability benefits for the Spanish-American War was 50 years after it finished. Now, in our analysis, we have essentially projected for this war based on the first Gulf War of 1991, because the eligibility criteria for our current troops is similar to those. And even though that war was very short, lasting for about a month, 44% of those troops applied for disability benefits, and we now pay $4.3 billion a year, which is the budget of the entire Centers for Disease Control, for example, to pay disability benefits to 170,000 Gulf War I veterans. So when you consider that our current troops are serving at least 15-month tours of duty, and many of them 30, 40 months in grueling conditions, we can expect that at least 44% of these troops will apply for and receive disability benefits. Third, let me describe the cost of the military reset. There are two dimensions to this. One is the equipment, and the other is really the personnel. The military equipment, vehicles, weapons, munitions are being used up now at 10 times the peacetime rate, but they're not being replaced at anything close to that. So there is an enormous backlog of replacements and repairs that is building up. Moreover, many of the repairs that are being done in the field, with the effect that they are essentially like, it's like patching a pothole as opposed to repaving the road. They're just making small repairs rather than fundamentally repairing the equipment. The cost of actually replenishing all of this military equipment and materiel is another substantial long-term cost. For example, our aircraft, which are supposed to be no more than 20 years old at the absolute most, are now have an average age of 24 years. Then there is the issue of our personnel, who are under enormous strain. They are not receiving the training they are supposed to. Our F-22 pilots, who are supposed to receive 20 to 25 hours of training, are getting 10. Our armored tank units, in order to be healthy, are supposed to be receiving 800 tank miles per year in training. They're getting 459. The list goes on and on. And in a recent survey, which is in this month's Foreign Policy magazine, of 3,400 very senior military officials, 88% said that the U.S. forces were under incredible strain, and two-thirds said that we are significantly weaker than we were 5 years ago. The other major cost that we've ignored so far is the cost of the fact that we have borrowed all of the money that we've spent to wage the war. And we have to, of course, repay this money with interest over the many coming years. We have borrowed virtually all of the $600 billion that we've spent to date. So we have interest to pay on what we've already borrowed. There is interest still due on what we have borrowed. There is interest on the interest, and there is interest on whatever we borrow for the rest of the war. Which brings us to the fourth cost, which is the cost of continuing combat operations. We are now spending $12 billion a month in Iraq alone, $16 billion if we include Afghanistan. If you add in the cost of taking care of veterans and replenishing the military, this easily doubles, so that we face the prospect of a $25 billion a month cost. That's another $600 billion if we stay there for another 2 years, another close to $1 trillion for 3 more years of the war. All of this together brings us to a total of around $3 trillion, but this is only looking at the federal budgetary costs, because so far we have completely ignored the social and the economic costs and the impact of this on the United States and the global economy. And this was the subject of the second part of the lecture.
Thank you, Linda. And now we'll welcome to the podium Joseph Stiglitz. Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you about this, I think, very important subject. I'm going to try to spend most of my time talking about the costs that go beyond the budget. Linda's described the very large budgetary costs that were an order of magnitude greater than the $50 billion that the administration said the war was going to cost at the beginning. As she pointed out, we are spending $50 billion now every 3 months, and that's just the upfront cost, not the cost down the line for the caring of the veterans and so forth. But there are large costs that go beyond these budgets. They're probably almost double those totals. And those come in two forms. There are the micro cost and there are the macro cost. The micro costs are fairly easy to understand. When somebody gets killed, for instance, he gets a $500,000, his parents, or his family, survivors, get $500,000. If he had been killed in a senseless automobile accident, he would have gotten a lot more. It's unpleasant to try to assess an economic value on a life, but government, juries have to do it all the time. When the government comes, for instance, to make a decision about whether to have a safety regulation or environmental regulation or any other kind of regulation, they ask, what is the cost? And then they ask, what is the benefit? And the benefit is the number of lives saved. And then they have to value a life saved. And the standard, there's a standard procedures that economists, and not only the U.S. government, governments all over the world do this. The value, the way they do that, they talk about the value of statistical life. And it represents in part the what they could have earned, but it's more than just what they could have earned. It's much more than that. And the standard number used, as I say, in a whole variety of government agencies is somewhere between $7 million per person and 9, 10, 11 million. In our analysis, we only use $7.2 million. The same kind of concept applies to disability, but it's even stronger. The pay that Linda described that people get when they get disabled is but a fraction of what they would have earned and but a fraction of what it costs to take care of them. And so we use the same kind of concept to figure out what a value of a statistical injury is. Many of the people returning are very badly disabled. They can't care for themselves. And so in one out of five families where there's a serious disability, somebody has to give up their job. And so we have to incorporate that as another one of the many costs that go beyond the budgetary cost. So these are examples of the kinds of costs, economic costs, costs to our society that are not born and don't show up in the federal budget, but are really part of the economic cost. There are a whole host of costs that we did not include because they're harder to quantify. The fact, for instance, that many of these people will be disabled means their families will have to be on Medicaid. They'll be stressing the states and localities for health care when the government doesn't provide adequate health care in the VA hospitals. They have to get health care elsewhere, and those costs are just shifted from the government to somebody else in our society. They don't disappear. So those are the microeconomic costs. And then there are the macroeconomic costs. Some people say that in this election there are two big issues, the war and the economy. And what we argue is that in some sense there's only one issue, and that's the war. Because the war has contributed in some very important ways to the current weaknesses, the woes in the American economy. There are three channels through which this is done. The first is through the impact on the price of oil. All of you, I'm sure, know that the price of oil has gone up. You see it every day. You may have forgotten that when we went to war, the price of oil was around $23, $25 a barrel. And futures markets expected it to remain at that for 10 years or more. A Of course, they understood that there was growing demand from China, India, other emerging markets. But they expected that there would be a corresponding increase in supply. That's what markets do. And there's a vast amount of oil in the Middle East, low cost, low extraction cost, and the markets anticipated that this supply would increase in tandem with the demand, and that was why the price was going to remain at $25 a barrel. The Iraq War changed that equation, and now the price of oil is over $100 a barrel. We think that the war is the single most important factor contributing to this vast increase in the price of oil. But because we wanted to have a discussion over what the costs of the Iraq War were, we didn't want to have a quibble. And it was a discussion that clearly this administration has not wanted to have with the American people. In our analysis, in that $3 trillion, which seems so much as it is, we only attributed $5 to $10 to the Iraq War. If we attributed the real amount, of course, we're talking adding on another couple trillion. And this is an example of, you know, why we believe that our estimate of the $3 trillion war is really vastly underestimates the true cost of this war. The second reason that the war has been bad for the economy is that expenditures, say for a contractor, a Filipino or Nepalese contractor working in Iraq, doesn't stimulate the American economy in the same way that an investment in education, roads, or spending here at home would do. So it doesn't give the strength, the stimulation to the economy in the short run, and it certainly doesn't provide the basis of long-term economic growth here in the United States. The third reason is that this war is different from any other war that the United States has fought in many ways, but one of the ways in which it's different is that this war is totally financed by deficits, by borrowing. In every other case, as America went to war, there was a discussion of what fraction of the cost should be shifted on to future generations and which fraction should be borne by the current generation. In this war, there was no discussion. In fact, remarkably, there was a tax cut for upper-income Americans right after we went into the war. And we already had a large deficit, which means that the entire cost of the war has been based on borrowing. About 40% of that borrowing has been from abroad, because Americans have not been saving. This is the first war since the Revolutionary War where we had to turn to foreigners to finance our venture. Well, these are some of the reasons that the war has not been good to the economy. And it should be clear, in the aftermath of World War II, there was a notion that wars were good for the economy. It helped the U.S. get out of the Great Depression. But at least since Keynes, we understand that you don't need a war to keep the economy strong. You can spend money in ways that lead to long-run growth rather than wasting it on a war. So you don't need wars to have a strong economy. In fact, the first Gulf War itself was one of the reasons that the economy went through the recession back in 91. Well, as I said, this war has been very bad for the economy. And one of the puzzles as we were writing the book was, why did the economy seem as strong as it did? Our analysis said it should really have been suffering much more than seemed to be the case. And there was an obvious answer to this puzzle, and that is while these factors were exerting a very strong downward pressure, loose monetary policy and lax regulations were helping boost the economy. We had a housing bubble, and that supported the consumption boom. The magnitude of this was enormous. More than $1.5 trillion were taken out of houses in what are called mortgage equity withdrawals, and most of that money went on to consumption. Savings savings in the United States went down to zero for the first time since the Great Depression. But it should have been clear that we were living on borrowed money and borrowed time, and it was just a matter of time before a day of reckoning came. Now, I think President Bush hoped it would come after November 2008. But like so many things associated with this war, things haven't gone quite as planned. And things started to unravel in August of this year. We end the book with a whole set of recommendations of how to try to prevent this kind of disaster happening again. Regrettably, we probably will wind up in a war again, but it doesn't have to be as costly and it doesn't have to be as badly managed as this war. Let me just try to describe very briefly some of the recommendations. They fall into two categories. One deals with the appropriations and budgetary process, the other with the treatment of our veterans, which has been absolutely shameful. On the budgetary side, it's extraordinarily important that we've been funding, as Linda said, we've been funding this war almost entirely by emergency appropriations, which are not subject to the kind of oversight that the regular budgetary process done deliberately because they wanted to short-circuit this oversight. But 5 years into a war, you should not be using emergency appropriations. And almost everybody, every person is elected, has said, this is a fundamental reform. Secondly, we need to change the way we do accounting. Accounting is important because it provides information. Information is important because without good information, you don't make good decisions. You tend to be penny wise and pound foolish. You don't invest in the MRAP, these vehicles that would have saved the lives of most of the people who have been killed, that would have avoided many of the injuries that resulted. But the administration was focused on saving money up front so people wouldn't see what was going on. And the net result is that these people, their family, are paying the price. But even the American taxpayers are paying the price because we will be paying those costs in terms of disability, health care, for the next 50 years. So you need comprehensive accounting, and you have to have accounting that goes beyond that part that's officially labeled the war cost, because if you don't, do that, it gets shifted into other departments. Linda pointed out the Labor Department, Social Security, all the cost in the budget are showing up in many other places besides the part that's labeled Iraq War. The third thing is this war is unusual in another way. It's the first time we privatized so much of the fighting. And the contractors have been very expensive. A security guard can cost more than $1,000 a day, order magnitude greater than what we would pay our own soldiers. And then we are providing competition for our own military, driving up the cost. Fourthly, we've tried to avoid increasing the size of the standing army, which means we've asked the same people to do sacrifice over and over again. We've extended their tours of duty. We've reduced the amount of time they have between tours of duty. We've asked them to do second, third, fourth tours of duty. We told them they thought they were signed up for 3 years. They told them, I'm sorry, you can't leave. You haven't read the fine print in your contract. A private employer that did that would be hauled up before courts. But the Department of Defense has been doing this repeatedly. And that's an example of just the other set of reforms, those reforms that affect the way we treat our veterans. The president talked about the vast unfunded entitlements of our Social Security, but we have, in the last 5 years, created a huge unfunded entitlement, an entitlement which they've actually worked to get, that is to say, they fought to get, and that is the disability and health care benefits. These amount, in our estimates, to over $600 billion. And yet it's not been funded, and that means it could be taken away by a whim of a future Congress. So it's very important that we fully fund these benefits. There's a marked contrast between the kinds of benefits we gave to those fighting in World War II. The GI Bill of Rights provided education. And many of the people fighting for us now have joined partly because they have no other economic opportunities. It's even more important for these people to have access to education. We need to provide a new GI Bill of Rights. And finally, our book, I think, helps to try to frame how we ought to think about exiting. There's a debate about whether when we exit, things will get worse, whether there will be chaos, or, as most Iraqis believe, things will get better. But that's not really the issue. The issue is, what do we get by staying another 2, 3, 4 or more years, or another 80 or 100 years? Things will be a little bit better, the chaos will be a little bit less, or it might be a little bit worse. The question we have to ask, though, is whatever the change, is it worth the $900 billion it will cost us to say another 3 years, another $1.2 trillion if we stay another 4 years? This is the kind of analysis that economists use all the time, marginal analysis. What is the benefit and what is the cost? This is a big program, and we ought not to shirk away from doing this hard kind of analysis it really merits and was not done when we went into the war in the first place. Finally, let me say that it was a really just mention a little say just something about the process of writing the book, which was we both began in a way as just an analytic exercise. We knew the costs were more than the government was saying. We knew the costs were beyond the budgetary cost, but we had no idea how great the discrepancy was between what they said and what is the true cost to our economy. And what we hope our book will do is to open up a discussion of these costs and whether the benefits we've gotten are worth those costs. Thank you.
Thank you to our distinguished speakers, Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, for your exciting presentation of a very depressing subject. We've seen a rather remarkable reaction to this pretty depressing subject. The New York Times had an op-ed piece describing it today, and even the Huffington Post featured it. So it brings me to the first question from the audience. In a media environment where substantive issues are reduced to glib sound bites, can your serious analysis find traction in the public discussion of the Iraq War?
Well, you know, we certainly hope so. We worked very, very hard to do this. I mean, I think, you know, we started from the premise that people, whatever you think about the war, whatever your opinion was about the war and the original decision, that people actually have a right to know how much it's costing. And that it's impossible for our Congress to make good decisions if they absolutely don't know what the cost is. As Joe was saying, we had no idea when we started this 3 years ago how many complex and hidden costs there would be. We had no idea how many things we would find that were really disturbing, upsetting, discrepancies, how badly we were treating our veterans. But, I mean, we hope that This book will help to stimulate that. And yes, it is difficult when you have a, generally speaking, a media that is happy to put the war on page 17 now. And, I mean, we look, we see every single day the things that used to be on the front page move to page 5 and now page 17. And these are still just as horrible as they've always been. You know, massive violence, 30, 40, 50, 100 people killed in a Baghdad pet market. You know, people, you know, in wheelchairs as suicide bombers, and yet they're in the back pages. So I think that for all of us in this room and all of our listeners, it behooves us to try and do what we can to bring it back to the front pages.
Let me suggest why I'm a little bit optimistic. One of the reasons is that in writing this book and in doing the research behind it, it turned out to be not the the dry kind of statistical work that we usually gauge in. It turned out, in part, to be a lot of sleuth work. Detective work is not the kind that we usually do. We began with the belief that, you know, citizens have a right to know. Our view was we shouldn't have had to write this book. The government should have been providing this information to us. But then we started discovering item after item of things that they were trying to keep from us. I mean, one of the things that Linda discovered. Why don't you tell the story about the number of injuries?
Well, I mean, one of the most extraordinary things that happened through this process is that when we were trying to understand the cost of taking care of injured veterans, we obviously assumed that we needed to know how many injured veterans there were in order to figure out the cost. Now, if you go to the regular Pentagon website, it says that there are 30,000 wounded veterans, but those are only wounded in combat. Now, if you look at the fatalities, that they give you a figure both for dead in combat and non-hostile deaths. For example, if you are driving at night because it's unsafe to drive during the day and you are killed, you appear on the death list. But if you were wounded in that car, you don't appear anywhere on the official statistics. Now, we actually were able, with the help of veterans organizations, and there is a very great man who's just walked in here in the back, Paul Sullivan, Director of Veterans for Common Sense, who actually helped us by using the Freedom of Information Act on behalf of veterans to find out how many there were who were wounded not in combat, but while they were in the field, wounded seriously enough to require being medically airlifted out of the country. And we found that the number was not 30,000, but 70,000. Now, after we found this out from the Freedom of Information Act website, and I published a paper on this, the Assistant Secretary of Health of the Pentagon phoned me up and phoned my dean at Harvard and said, "Where are you getting these numbers? They're wrong." And I said, "Well, this is your website. this is your website." And he said, "Oh." he couldn't believe it, but he said, "Well, you have to fax it to me." And I said, "Well, I can email you your own website." He said, "Oh, no. That's classified. You have to fax me my own website." So we faxed him his own website. And I thought that was the end of it, but a couple of weeks later, a number of the veterans organizations phoned me, and what do you think happened next? So they actually changed the website. They changed the website so that the Department of Veterans Affairs was no longer permitted to use the larger number that they had been using. And within the military, they reconfigured the format of this so that unless you knew what it looked like before, you had to add up numbers from so many different columns that it was difficult, not impossible, but difficult to get to the total number. And this is the kind of thing that I have to admit that before I began working on this, I never would have believed it. But we have faced this in many, many, we have faced this kind of obfuscation in many, many areas.
It's amazing that that's true, and it leads to a question, which is, has anyone made an effort to cost previous wars in the way that you're doing this?
I don't think anybody's made the kind of comprehensive effort. There are we refer to the fact that this is the second most costly war in our history, because there are have been studies that have looked at the operational cost, the upfront cost. But as we've emphasized, the total cost to the economy is much larger than the upfront cost. And we, one of our recommendations is that this should be part of the standard practice whenever we go to war. Hopefully we don't do it very often.
You recommend, in fact, a series of accounting improvements in the way in which we account for all this. What do you think the chances are of your Sarbanes-Oxley approach to the military government will be accepted?
Well, I think that it needs to be given serious consideration. The Pentagon spends $500 billion a year with no accountability as to where the money is spent. And this is not just us pointing this out, but people, including David Walker, the Comptroller General, the Congressional Research Service, the Congressional Budget Office, every serious independent budget analysis unit has looked at the Pentagon budget and concluded that it is impossible to know where the money is going. Now, in terms of piecing together the cost of the war, it's very challenging because money is appropriated for things like repairs, and you don't know if that repair is in Kansas or in Kuwait or in Kandahar or in Iraq. You have to follow the trail. But beyond that, if you know anything about accounting, the Pentagon financial statements are a complete travesty with thousands of material weaknesses in every possible area. In inventory, they don't even know how much stuff they have. So it really would require a very, very, a sort of the entire defense establishment to get religion on the importance of trying to understand where the money is going. And there are many people in the Pentagon who want to do this. There are a number of retired generals who have spoken out. There are many military officers in the mid-ranks who feel that in order to be able to execute their budgets properly, they need better controls, better transparency. The question is that why is it that in the private sector we are requiring personal responsibility at the top in the form of Sarbanes-Oxley, despite all of the complaints about it, but in the government we're not requiring anything close to that standard of accountability for where money goes.
And let me just make one more comment, which is that in many other areas of government, there are future costs. And the CBO, right, the Congressional Budget Office, which is the part of the Congress that looks at these things, does not look 10 years into the future. But the problem about war injuries is 10 years is not enough. This is really an unusual kind of expenditure program. So 10 years is only scratching. As Linda pointed out, World War II, veterans' expenditures peaked more than four decades after the end of hostilities. So you really need to reform this if we're going to get any comprehensive set of accounts of what is going on.
Several of our audience members ask this question. Have you made or has there been an effort to extrapolate the potential cost, however indirect, the exercise of an immediate withdrawal from Iraq? Or have you considered the costs of withdrawing and how you would predict and estimate those?
One way, let me put it the other way, which is we know that one of the important points of our analysis is that even if we immediately left, cost would continue. And a lot of people have overestimated as a result the magnitude of the peace dividend. We are going to have to be paying for the disability the veterans for decades to come. We still have to bring back the equipment. So these are costs that we will have to face no matter when we leave. The issue of exiting, the timing of exiting, is the extra cost that we're going to have to pay if we stay longer. And that goes back to the numbers we're talking about, $12 billion a month. And they keep going up. They were $4 billion a month in the beginning of the war. And the reason, one of the reasons they're going up is the point that Linda mentioned, that we've had a lot of deferred maintenance. We kept postponing repair, and you can only do that for a while. And so you have to spend more and more to repair equipment that should have been repaired in a more timely way. So it is quite conceivable that if we stay longer, that $12 billion will get larger and larger.
I would just add that in terms of how much it would cost to actually withdraw and how long it would take, there have been a few studies that have looked at this. Larry Korb, who is a defense expert in Washington, has written a study. He estimates it would take about a year to bring our troops and our equipment home. Now, we have about 250,000 troops in theater now. They are not, of course, all in Iraq, but many are in Kuwait. Many are in, you know, on based in Navy ships off the coast or in the surrounding regions. But you're talking about a group of about that magnitude. We have about 500,000 deployed at home who are either on home leave or preparing and in training, getting ready to go back out. So managing that demobilization and the transportation would probably take about a year. I mean, we have in our model been very conservative in estimating the cost of just bringing equipment home. We've estimated about a $17 billion cost for eventual bringing of all of the equipment back. But you know, that's the kind of order of magnitude that we're looking at.
Can I just make one more point, which is there hasn't been a real leveling with the American people about what the cost of staying would be, because the Army, the armed forces, have really been depleted. And there's a general sense that we could not stay at the current level of commitment without something drastically being done. That there is a recognition that there will have to be an increase in the size of our armed forces, but it hasn't been put into place. And it really, if we were to stay there for any extended period of time beyond this spring, in a significant way, we are going to have to find the resources to do that.
Inevitably, you get dragged into political issues as economists. One question.
There's no politics in writing this book. Let me make that clear.
I didn't think so, and I thought I missed something maybe. A question from the audience. Why do you think these emergency budgets for the Iraq War seem to be of such little concern to the various experts and to Congress? And I would add on, have you briefed any of the current presidential candidates and or their staffs on this subject? And have any of them picked up on it?
I would really, really like to compliment whoever submitted that question. If you identify yourself, you'll be very, very popular with us. The issue of these emergency supplemental budgets, just to make clear what they are, is that normally when the budget process is a long, protracted process which goes through the Congress, and many people from both parties have a chance to look at budget proposals and look at how much money is requested for something and whether that makes sense. Now, there is a vehicle, a sort of special vehicle called the emergency supplemental vehicle, which is supposed to be for only two categories of expenditures, either for genuine emergencies like Hurricane Katrina or an earthquake or something where the key is to get money to the field very fast, bypassing all the regular checks and balances, or a new program that Congress enacts during the year that it wants to start right away. Now, we have now been using this vehicle, these emergency supplementals, which arguably could have been used for the initial invasion of Afghanistan. But we are now years on. We have spent all of this money through this emergency supplemental vehicle, which means that this has circumvented all the usual process, and it has denied both the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress, the budget experts, the chance to actually look at the money and figure out, well, how much does it actually cost for Halliburton to do this thing? So it's inevitable that there will be profiteering, corruption, overpayments to contractors, and many, many errors. Now, why, politically speaking, why has this happened? Because there has been, in my view, a kind of a sort of accounting conspiracy of both parties, nobody willing to actually look at the fact that there is not the money, unless spending is cut or taxes are increased, to pay for this war. So this has enabled everybody to sort of put it off to the side, as if there were some kind of side piggy bank, except that it's just borrowings. Now, and the fact that it has been 25 different separate supplementals, and we know because we see them in the newspapers all the time, another $40 billion here, another $79 billion here, another $25 billion here, has enabled our legislators to vote on little dribs and drabs. So the president submits another one and another one and another one, and the Congress approves another one and another one, and that's how it's been going on throughout. Last year, the Congress, the newly elected Democratic Congress, put its foot down and said they weren't going to allow this anymore, but this year it's happening again. So it didn't work.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio and television program with Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, co-authors of The $3 Trillion War. Staying on the political scene, one of our audience members suggests that the White House claims that you, I guess the two of you, lack the courage to consider the cost of doing nothing and the cost of failure. What is your response?
Well, the first was I was very impressed that they commented on her book before it was published. The second point was that response that we had was the White House lacked the courage of its conviction. We went to war for democracy, but democracy is about more than periodic elections. It's about informed citizenry participating in decision-making. But you can't have informed citizens if they don't know what the war is costing. And they have been deliberately trying to keep that information from the American people. We should not have had to use the Freedom of Information Act to do what they're doing. And there are, you know, lots of other things going on that most people don't know about. And if they knew about, would be outraged. I mean, for instance, just to give you one other example, we just recently discovered, but others may have known about it, that the contractors, Linda mentioned that they get these very large bonuses for signing up and for re-enlisting. But if, for instance, 1 month into their three-year period, they get injured badly enough that they can't continue fighting, the Department of Defense demands that they pay back their bonus. After all, they didn't fulfill the terms of the contract, which was to fight for 3 years. Now, this is the kind of thing that we found unbelievable, and Congress is also finding this unbelievable. They're beginning to change it. But there hasn't been an open discussion of these kinds of practices. We think that if the president really has the courage of his convictions, he would really have a discussion about these costs. I was giving a testimony to the Joint Budget Committee last Thursday, and the chairman pointed out that he had invited the White House to come down and testify on what the costs were. They had made some criticism of some other estimates that had been done by the Congressional Budget Office, by the Joint Economic Committee, and they're willing to quibble, but they're not willing to come up with their own. And the answer, fact is that with this invitation, they've refused so far to come down and provide their own numbers and to submit their numbers to the kind of scrutiny that they ought to be submitted to.
I would just add that we seem to be seeing a pattern here. When the war was first declared, the White House said it was going to cost $50 billion. And their own economic advisor, Larry Lindsey, said it would be costing $200 billion, and he was fired. Then 2 years later, Joe and I wrote our first paper in which we said that the war would cost $1 trillion, and they said that was rubbish. And then the next year, their own Congressional Budget Office, which is bipartisan, said it would cost between $1.7 to $2 trillion. You know, and now we are saying it's going to cost $3 trillion, which is actually lower than the Joint Economic Committee, which is saying $3.5 trillion, and they are querying it again. So the facts don't seem to mesh, you know, with what they're looking at. And I think that the White House credibility on the issue of cost is you know, very, very seriously shot. But I think taking the White House aside, there is enormous interest among many of the Republicans in Congress, you know, as well as the Democrats, in trying to understand how much the war is really costing. And I would say that we have had a fair amount of interest from many people in Congress who, because there is not a good way, a good accounting system for figuring it out, and a lot of interest from people in the military who have said, we applaud you for doing this, and we, you know, we want to look at it, and, you know, and who have participated in helping us throughout this process.
Now, let me just make two brief comments. One is, in this testimony, in this hearing in Washington, one of the Republican members of the committee, Ron Paul, was as disturbed as we were about the fact that this war has been totally financed by deficits. And the second point is, in the other part of the White House response to our book was, they started mentioning 9/11. You know, our response to this is, the Iraq War had nothing to do with 9/11. That this is, in fact, the kind of disinformation of trying to shift the focus from the war to something that's unrelated to the Iraq War. And, in fact, in our book, one of the things that we point out is not only is there an economic opportunity cost, that is to say, resources have a cost, and if you use them in one place, it takes them away from another, there's also a security opportunity cost. While we were focusing our attention on Iraq, where there were no weapons of mass destruction, another country, North Korea, joined the nuclear club. While we were focusing on Iraq, the problems in Afghanistan, which were linked in some ways to 9/11, became worse, and we are now losing the battle in two countries, not just one.
Would you support the suggestion that you go to war with the government you have? I'll move along. Has there been any mention of a Marshall Plan, sort of an approach to rebuilding Iraq, and how much would that cost?
Well, the reconstruction, one of the most tragic stories of the U.S. operations in Iraq is that we tried a Marshall Plan for Iraq. In the summer of 2003, after the initial invasion, the president went to Congress and said he had to have the $20 billion to rebuild Iraq. Now, this was something where he actually, the president, went to the mat for this. Congress said we should lend the money, we should not give the money. They were very reluctant. And the president absolutely went all out, said it was a must-have. And he said, we must do it because if we don't get the electricity back on, get the water running, we're going to lose the hearts and minds of the people. So he managed to get the $20 billion through a reluctant Congress. It became available in September 2003. But then, this is another one of these unbelievable stories, due to basically squabbling between the congressional committee, which wanted competitive bidding for the contracts, and was requiring the Pentagon secretary, then Rumsfeld, to send a letter to the chairman if he was going to not do competitive bidding, and Rumsfeld's refusal to send a letter to the chairman. This money was not spent, so that by the following spring, none of this money had yet been spent or put out to request for proposals. Much of the money was then reabsorbed back into the Office of Management and Budget. a lot of the money was eventually spent for non-reconstruction items. The original money was supposed to be very specifically for things like the electricity grid, for painting schools and police stations and so forth. And even by the time it got unstuck, the security situation had deteriorated very much in Iraq. And it became much, much harder to get companies who were willing to bid on some of these things. And, of course, the Pentagon Procurement Office is pretty slow at the best of times. And many of these were civilian-type contracts that were not their traditional strong point. So you had this tragedy where really the money was there and it was not spent. And even now, years later, I mean, much of that money never was spent. And it was in that period of time that many would say that we did lose hearts and minds, because we are in a situation today, 5 years later, where most people in Iraq still do not have electricity for more than a couple of hours a day.
Professor Stiglitz, with someone of your stature, with a Nobel Prize for economics, we have a lot of questions about the economy today. So in the last 3 minutes, could you please explain how bad is the current situation and what do we have to do to get out of it?
Well, it's very bad. To link it back to Iraq a little bit, you know, the situation in Iraq is so bad that 2 million out of the 28 million people have fled the country. And that's in addition to probably 1 million people who've been killed, and in addition to the 2 million people who've been displaced within their country. So when we talk about our problems, we ought to put it in a little bit in perspective on how bad things are in Iraq, and what role we played in contributing to those problems. For the American economy, as I said, the war has been very bad, and the nature of it has been covered over by those lax regulation, loose monetary policies. And the consequence of this is that we have a financial system that is in the process of unraveling. We expect about 2 million, a little more than 2 million Americans will lose their homes this year. That will depress housing prices. That will mean more and more homes will go into default. The banking system will be, therefore, further weakened. These American financial institutions created complex products. They said that they were trying to manage risk, but in fact they created risk. So these complex products are so non-transparent that no one really knows where the risk is and where the problems are. So the result of this lack of transparency is that no one wants to lend to anybody, and because the banks don't want to trust each other. They know how bad their own balance sheets are, and so they suspect others are at least as bad. And so that is why there is this process of credit crunch. It's likely going to begin to spill over from one market, from the mortgage market, into other markets. For instance, some of the banks have just begun to demand higher margin requirements of hedge funds. A few hedge funds have had problems. They can't meet those their requirements. They've had to sell their assets, and that will, if this happens in a significant way, it will have a broader depressing effect on the economy. The most important aspect of this is to realize that America has been living beyond its means. We've been borrowing $850 billion from other countries. And it's very hard for this to continue. In the form of at the household level, Americans had a zero savings rate. What enabled that was the ability to borrow against rising housing prices. Those housing prices are now falling. So it's going to be very difficult for them to take out hundreds of billions of dollars that they have taken out from their houses and would have sustained the American economy over the last 5 years. So the particular game that enabled the American economy to have this consumption-based growth over the last 5 years, that particular game is over. Now, it had to come to an end at some point. And the question is, how do we begin the process of restructuring our economy, and how do we begin the process of how do we make sure that the transition to dealing with these problems is done in the most effective way? Now, unfortunately, the stimulus package that Congress passed was too late, too little, and badly designed. Other than that, it's fine. But just to highlight, the magnitude is around $150 billion. Remember what I said, the amounts taken in mortgage equity withdrawals were in the order of magnitude of hundreds of billions of dollars. They just don't, they're in the same, they're not in the same order of magnitude. The most effective stimulus, the biggest bang for the buck, would have been increasing unemployment insurance. But the president vetoed that. The second most important thing would have been to offset the reductions in state and local tax revenues. State and local tax revenues are going to be going down. Incomes are going to go down. Property values are going down. And all of the states have what they call balanced budget frameworks. Balanced budget frameworks mean if the revenues go down, expenditures have to go down, and that's going to have a depressing effect. We're just beginning to see the unwinding of the American economy. Well, you don't wait for the disaster to happen. You put in money now and that you can add money in terms of the shortfall of the tax revenues. Well, that was not included in the package. What wasn't good in the package were some tax rebates. That will increase consumption or reduce the reduction in consumption. But America's overall weakness is not a shortfall in consumption. And so if you were thinking about designing a stimulus package that was at the same time addressed at the long-term needs, it's not where you would have begun. Now, there was a small piece there for investment. But again, it was very badly designed because it was not focused at the margin. In other words, most of the money will go to firms that would have done the investment anyway. What you want to do is have an incremental investment tax credit where you say if you increase your investment, you get a credit. So again, it was mainly just a gift to the corporate sector. So this was not a very well-designed. America's real long needs are a result of underinvestment in infrastructure, education, research. These are the things that America really needs right now. The levees in New Orleans, if we had invested in that, we would have saved hundreds of billions of dollars. The return on that investment it would have been enormous. There's a list of the leading airports in the world, 10 leading airports. Not one of them is in America. And eventually, these underinvestments affect the productivity of the private sector. These are complements to investments in the private sector. So this is where we should have been focusing our attention. It's what China did in the global downturn in 1997-98. They said, we can't allow our economy to suffer for the slowdown in the global economy. And they followed standard Keynesian recipes. They stimulated their economy with infrastructure. The economy slowed down from 8% to 7% growth, still not bad. But they laid the foundations for the growth that they've had in the last decade of 10 and 11%. It sort of shows you what good economic management can do. But I want to conclude by bringing this back to the Iraq War. In his testimony last Thursday, the head of the central bank, Bernanke, pointed out that the situation today is very different than the situation in 2001. The room for maneuver has been reduced. One of the reasons the room for maneuver has been reduced is that today we have large deficits. Then we had a surplus. One of the reasons we have a large deficit is because we're fighting this war. We are spending on the two wars $200 billion this year, and that doesn't include the amounts that are hidden in other parts of the budget. We're spending $160 billion on the war, and this money is not providing the stimulus to the American economy, as I said before, that other kinds of well-designed expenditures would have done, and that would have at the same time provided a framework for enhancing productivity of America in the long term. So in a way, the problems coming back, the problems the American economy face today are very much linked to the problems of Iraq.
On that cheerful note, we're going to unfortunately have to end this discussion, but our thanks to Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes, co-authors of The $3 Trillion War. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio and in television. My name is Bob Saldick, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board. We are the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion. This meeting is adjourned.